Today on Against the Grain, many who are concerned with the unfolding climate emergency have pinned great hope on the election of Joe Biden and Democratic control of the Senate. But as sociologist Richard Lockman observes, progressive expectations of Democratic politicians have regularly been dashed. He argues that a different approach to forcing elites into action is more effective, combining disruptive direct action with lawsuits and economic pressure, especially on the financial sector. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. As some of his last acts in office, Donald Trump is trying to roll back environmental regulations that limit fossil fuels, including drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, the Enbridge tar sands pipeline in Minnesota, and the construction of hundreds of gas-fired power plants. Progressives are hoping that Joe Biden, once in office, will block such initiatives and are trying to pressure him. My guest Richard Lockman and his co-authors Kevin Young and Michael Schwartz argue that lobbying Democratic Party politicians has yielded too little. In the essay, A Tipping Point for the Defeat of Fossil Fuels, How to Stop Big Energy in Its Tracks, quite literally, they make the case for a bolder approach, targeting fossil fuel companies, their investors in the world of finance, along with mass disruptive action, such as that which has successfully derailed the construction of oil pipelines. And they suggest that much can be done at the state rather than federal level. Richard Lockman is the author of First Class Passengers on a Sinking Ship, Elite Politics and the Decline of Great Powers, published by Verso. He's professor of sociology at the State University of New York, Albany. Richard, you and your co-authors make the case against directing most of our energies around the climate crisis at Democratic politicians. As you see it, how successful in the past has pressuring Democratic officials been to get them to act against climate change?
Not very successful. I mean, we can look back at Obama's administration and, you know, for the most part, he pursued what he called an all-of-the-above policy, where he encouraged green energy, and there was, you know, significant investment in that, in the stimulus that was passed right when he took office. But he also encouraged building of gas-fired plants. The great boom in fracking took place under Obama, and there was continued oil drilling. I mean, some of the most outrageous places to drill were blocked by him, but, you know, it was not a green policy for the most part. And, you know, if there's a change under Biden, it's not going to be because Biden personally has any real commitment to green energy. And the people he's appointed so far certainly don't have a record of showing that commitment. It'll be because of pressure from environmentalists.
You mentioned those he's appointed so far. What do we know about the direction that he's taking things in?
Well, I mean, in terms of appointments, the main one he has is Cedric Richmond, who's a African-American congressman from Louisiana and has been, you know, because he's members of Congress tend to represent local industries, he throughout his career has been an enthusiastic supporter of big oil and fossil fuels in general. So for Biden to give somebody like that a prominent position is a bad indication. And, you know, he hasn't, you know, some of the people he's picked, you know, have written essays, you know, given speeches saying we need to be interested in green energy, but none of them have a record of any real activism in that direction. So, you know, we can't sit back and say, oh, this is wonderful. There are all these committed environmentalists in Biden's administration. You know, we can just enjoy this switch in policy. we're going to have to apply pressure. It'll be easier to apply pressure on Biden than it was under Trump, but there has to be consistent pressure and smart targeting of projects that, you know, can be blocked by regulation or where the financial logic behind it is weak, and so that can be more easily canceled.
Well, let's talk more about that, because I think it probably is disheartening to some listeners to hear that the track record for pressuring Democrats to take action on the climate emergency have been pretty dismal. And I think for a lot of people who may identify as progressive, that's kind of how leverage is put on those in power by focusing on electoral officials. So since you're arguing that's not the case, can you tell us what better strategies are there for what is obviously an incredibly urgent situation, the climate crisis?
Well, I think we need to begin with the understanding that decisions about, you know, what sorts of energy facilities are going to be built is for the most part in the hands of capitalists. And so they are the ones who need to be our target. And the way to do that is to create as much uncertainty about the safety and profitability of their investments in fossil fuels. You know, and that's where protests, lawsuits, and efforts to pressure regulators all matter. You know, we've seen massive protests that have succeeded in blocking or at least delaying the Keystone and Dakota Access pipelines. And, you know, what that means for investors is their money's tied up. You know, they've put all this money into building this pipeline, and until the pipeline's completed and open, they're not getting anything back. And so when capitalists see this happening, it makes them doubt that putting money into pipelines is a good idea. There are other places they can invest that are much surer.
So to be clear, you're saying then that while we kind of assume that electoral officials have the power, that actually really the power in these decisions resides with the capitalists themselves, those who own the corporations, fossil fuel corporations and other extractive corporations, and that our energies are better spent targeting them directly rather than targeting the politicians who we're afraid will be swayed by such captains of industry.
Yes, we have to pressure them, and then also the financial firms that loan money for fossil fuel projects or invest in them. And, you know, they too want to have safe investments. You know, they don't want to put millions or billions of dollars into a project that is delayed for years and years or never gets to be completed. And so, and to the extent that government is involved in energy, the biggest part of that is not direct investment. The U.S. government, you know, doesn't build energy plants. What it does is it gives access to federal lands, it weakens regulation, or it offers subsidies. So, you know, certainly the government does play a role, but it's a secondary one. And we need to be smart about seeing what are the points of weakness in each of these projects and what sort of pressure can be applied at each of these points.
Well, can you give us an assessment of the vulnerabilities of the fossil fuel industry at this moment, seeming, you know, all powerful and certainly beneficiaries of some of the funds from bailouts connected to COVID, but what are the points of vulnerability here and what are the causes of that vulnerability?
There are a number. You know, one, you know, on sort of the largest macroeconomic level, it's that there's too much oil and natural gas in the world. You know, for a number of years, there, you know, has been massive investment, more and more energy sources have been opened up. And at the same time, the cost of wind and solar energy has been dropping. So at this moment, you know, for anybody who's looking to build a new power source, it's cheaper to do it with wind and solar than to do it with oil or even natural gas. So, you know, from a purely financial point of view, it's nuts for investors to put money into drilling for oil or natural gas, especially since the easy sources for that have already been exploited. So now the drilling has to take place deep in the ocean, in extreme environments like in the Arctic Wildlife Reserve, where the costs are really high. So just on an economic basis, these oil companies are in a vulnerable position. You know, another weakness that they face is that their projects are more and more visible and they're being subject to protests. You know, indigenous communities especially have been in the forefront of that, because in the West, many of the projects have to go through their lands. And so that gives them a legal basis to object. And also indigenous people live in the Dakotas, live in Alaska. So they're there on the site and they can protest. You know, another vulnerability is one that's existed since the beginning of the environmental movement, that environmental groups have been very shrewd at finding laws that can provide a basis for suits and can tie up these projects. And one of the more recent changes has been that some of these suits have been launched not just against projects that are under construction or planned, but projects that already exist. And so there have been court rulings that existing pipelines have to be shut because when they were built decades ago, indigenous communities didn't get the opportunity to exercise their legal rights to object to that. And then, you know, finally, all of this comes together and provides a basis to put pressure on, you know, what's called the money pipeline, the banks, insurers, and others that are essential for any project moving ahead. You know, banks don't like to lose money. And if they feel that these projects are risky, they're less likely to invest, and they can be pushed in that direction by decisions of state pension funds and universities to divest from fossil fuels. And this is one area where putting pressure on the Biden administration really could make a difference. That financial regulators in the federal government have the authority to demand that financial firms and fossil fuel companies as well look and see what the risks are to their assets as a result of the dropping price of wind and solar, protests against fossil fuel projects, and global warming in general. And so if they can be forced to do that, then, you know, under all the existing laws and regulations where investors need to, you know, take their clients' interests into account and not make reckless investments, you know, that in many cases will force them not to invest in these sorts of projects. And the oil companies recognize that. You know, they asked the Trump administration to pressure regulators not to do that, and in fact, to do the opposite. So, you know, if we look at the plan that the, you know, Trump administration wants to allow an auction for leases in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge a couple of days before Trump leaves office, and financial firms are saying, we're not going to loan money to bidders on these projects because we think it's too risky. And so in an outrageous move, the Trump administration got one of the financial regulators to say, well, if you do that, if you don't loan money for these projects, you're discriminating against indigenous people in Alaska and you're discriminating against oil companies as a class. Well, you know, this probably won't stand. They're leaving office. Biden can reverse that the minute he comes in. And, you know, that's one that he almost certainly will do. You know, that's one of the rare instances where the two parties really dramatically disagree. The Republicans have been pushing for years to allow drilling in the wildlife refuge, and Democrats have been stalwart at blocking that. So, you know, that won't go ahead, but, you know, this sort of symbolic case exposes real opportunities for environmentalists and real vulnerabilities for the oil company.
Sure. What about the status of fracking that boomed under Obama? Where is that?
It's now collapsing. I mean, there are various problems with fracking. One is that, it produced so much gas that it, the price of natural gas dropped. And so, then these wells no longer were profitable. Fracking is not a cheap way to extract gas from underground. And so, when prices were above $80 a barrel, then, by comparison, the oil and gas you got from that could be profitable. Now that the prices have dropped to $40 or $50 a barrel, suddenly it's no longer profitable. And in fact, the fracking industry never was profitable. They were able to borrow, in aggregate tens of billions of dollars, but they never turned a profit. And, it was sort of this fantasy of, we're producing all this oil and gas, this, has to be a bonanza, at some point it'll become profitable, but since it's so expensive to extract, it never became that. And so what we're seeing now is a collapse of many of these fracking companies. With fracking, like, with most energy, you have a situation where when you, have a new way of extracting oil and gas, or you are exploring, new fields, at the beginning you have, relatively small companies involved in that. And if it works out well, they make a huge amount of money and they sell out to the big firms. And if it doesn't work or the price drops, they go bankrupt and, they'll then either disappear, or in some cases, these small companies are being bought up at very low prices by big oil companies, and the banks that loan the money are losing out. Their loans aren't going to be repaid. I mean, in fact, what the banks do with oil and gas is, what they did, back in 2007, 2008 with real estate, that they package these loans into securities and they sell them off to people who don't understand what they're buying. And so as these fracking companies go bankrupt, in fact, the banks aren't the ones who are taking the biggest losses. It's pension funds and others who, bought these financial instruments.
Right, and we know how that all ended up. I'm speaking with sociologist Richard Lachman. He is the co-author of an essay titled "A Tipping Point for the Defeat of Fossil Fuels: How to Stop Big Energy in Its Tracks," quite literally. And you can find a link to that on againstthegrain.org. You, of course, are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Well, how have the fortunes of the fossil fuel industry, you've been talking about how easy to access fossil fuels are getting scarcer, of glut. Of course, there's the Saudi-Russian price war. But how has the fossil fuel industries fared during the pandemic? Has that changed anything in terms of the terrain that they're operating on?
Yes, it has, because, this is one of the areas where demand has dropped most sharply. People aren't traveling, they're not commuting to work, many offices and factories have closed down, so there's a lot less need for fossil fuels. And so the price, which was dropping before that because of fracking, because, as you mentioned, the Saudi-Russian oil price war, has now dropped even further. And, as with various other industries during the pandemic, it's not clear how many of them can hold on, how many have the resources to last till the pandemic ends and, they assume demand will be restored. So if you combine that with, the political weakness that they have, with the concern about climate change and the demand to do something to reduce CO2 emissions, they're in a weaker position than they've ever been.
Well, let me ask you, and you've touched on this, but ask you in depth about the financial companies that are what you point to as one of the vulnerabilities for fossil fuels. Financial companies have raked in enormous profits over the years from fossil fuel investments. It's been very lucrative for them, but now they're getting wary. What are the signs of this, and what is that wariness based on?
I mean, it's based on the understanding that it's highly unlikely that new oil fields, new natural gas fields can ever turn a profit. And you know, if climate change is taken seriously, which in more and more of the world it is, demand for oil and gas are going to drop. You know, increasingly, energy is going to come from green sources. You know, there already are enough proven reserve oil and gas fields that have been discovered, you know, that where their pipelines attached, where they're ready to be exploited to bring global warming, you know, well beyond the level at which there's going to be irreversible catastrophic climate change. You know, so most of the oil and gas that's already been discovered can never be pumped out. It can never be burned, or you know, the planet won't be livable for humans. You know, so if you know, if that's the fundamental situation, it's ridiculous to spend money to look for new sources of oil and gas that can never be used. And these financial firms are realizing that. And, you know, to some extent, some of the really big fossil fuel corporations are understanding that as well. And, you know, in essence, what they've decided to do is, you know, just maximize the profit that they can get from their existing fossil fuel sources and not burn up money literally looking for new sources. So, you know, British Petroleum has for the most part stopped exploration. And of course, if you don't spend money on that, you know, then all of your profits can just be passed out to your investors. And, but, you know, that means that, you know, these companies are then either going to disappear or they're going to have to, you know, turn themselves into green energy companies. And, you know, to some extent, some of the oil companies are doing that, but, you know, in that realm, they're facing competition from new companies, but, you know, entirely specialized in wind or solar.
What about insurers? Are those companies also getting cold feet about insuring the increasingly risky fossil fuel industry?
I mean, yes, they are. You know, and part of it is because if you drill in extreme locations, the probability of an accident gets much higher, and the cost of these accidents are gigantic. You know, we're talking about billions or tens of billions of dollars. It's enough to bankrupt an insurer. And you know, so then, you know, they ask, you know, what level of premiums would justify taking that risk? And, you know, then we'll either raise the premiums really high and find, you know, nobody's willing to buy insurance at that price, or they, you know, just don't offer that insurance. And, you know, if a project doesn't have insurance, what bank is going to invest? Because if there's a lawsuit, then everything can be lost. And in many cases, regulations require insurance. You know, you can't build unless you have an insurance policy. You know, so this is another point of vulnerability that can stop many of these projects.
Well, listening to what you're detailing may give heart to people who have felt sort of despondent about the prospects of the fossil fuel industry disappearing or going extinct, and the idea that perhaps through the invisible hand of the market, since fossil fuel production is just really not that profitable given all these risks, and the visible hand perhaps of protesters, that this may have a happy ending. But you and your co-authors are not so sanguine about that, about the idea that the fossil fuel industry will just wither away because of the economic logic of the expense of fossil fuels. And you point to the nuclear power industry as an example of how industries that are not economically viable can chug along if the government intervenes in their favor. Can you tell us about that and the general concerns about the longevity of the fossil fuel industry?
Yeah, I mean, it remains politically very powerful. It still generates, at least for the big oil companies, enormous profit. And, these companies are geographically concentrated. So in various states like Texas, Louisiana, the Dakotas, and Alaska, they remain the dominant industries. And so they, have the state governments and the members of those state congressional delegations, really in their pockets. And so you have, this core of officials who, for the sake of their political careers, are committed to smoothing the way for these projects to go ahead and offering subsidies. And, one of the things that's become, more public as concern about climate change has been rising is the extent of government subsidies for fossil fuels, not just in the United States, but in much of the world. And, so of course, if you get enough subsidies, a money-losing industry suddenly turns into a money-making industry. And, we saw that with nuclear power, that, almost all the costs of research of developing the plans to build nuclear reactors was paid by the federal government. There's a law still on the book that caps liability for a nuclear power plant accident at a very low level. So even though insurers are unwilling to insure these plants, it doesn't matter because they're, essentially invulnerable to lawsuits. And much of the cleanup costs are borne by the federal government. So, that's an industry that's a money loser, but has been made financially viable by federal subsidies. And to some extent, that's the case with oil and gas, that you have projects that never would have moved ahead, but, by various sorts of subsidies then become viable. And it's more of a problem in the rest of the world. And, it turns out that a lot of foreign aid from the U.S., from European governments, either directly or funneled through the World Bank, is spent on building fossil fuel plants in the global south. India now is building hundreds of coal-powered plants, even though coal is a much more expensive fuel source than green energy. Why are they doing that? Well, they were able to get loans from the Indian government, from the World Bank. And so you're going to have these plants that are built, and they're going to be pumping out CO2 for decades because of these subsidies. So this is a point that we need to focus on, where we need to pressure governments. And, the other countries have been successful with that. Boris Johnson, of all people, just this past week announced that Britain was going to end its subsidies for fossil fuels. And he identified that much of those subsidies, were for fossil fuel plants in other countries funneled through foreign aid. So, if Boris Johnson can be pressured to do that, Joe Biden can as well.
Richard Lachman is my guest. He's a sociologist. We'll return with him in a moment.
Tell me about
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about what it might take to force elites to take action against fossil fuels. I'm joined by the co-author of the essay, A Tipping Point for the Defeat of Fossil Fuels, How to Stop Big Energy in Its Tracks, quite literally, and that you can find at againstthegrain.org. Richard Lockman is author of First Class Passengers on a Sinking Ship, Elite Politics and the Decline of Great Powers, which is published by Verso, and he's professor of sociology at SUNY Albany. And I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you had been talking about how governments can keep industries on life support, even when they're not viable, like the nuclear power industry, and as we're seeing with the fossil fuel industry. Can you tell us about the role of the U.S. government's Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, or OCC, to make financial institutions invest in fossil fuels despite their unease about it?
Yeah, the OCC is one of a number of federal regulatory agencies that are able to make financial firms do things or block them from doing other things. And, you know, this is the agency that, engaged in the maneuver that I mentioned earlier, that when financial firms said, you know, we're not going to give loans to companies that are going to be bidding to drill in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, you know, the Trump administration put pressure on the OCC to say that, you know, not doing that was discrimination against oil companies and also discrimination against indigenous people in Alaska. And, you know, this illustrates a number of points. You know, one, this, you know, shows a pathway by which fossil fuel companies are able to get the federal government to intervene on their behalf to make projects that, you know, aren't financially viable on their own move ahead. And it, you know, also identifies for the rest of us a point of pressure that we can target. You know, that when Biden comes in, you know, it'll be very easy to say to him and, you know, his administration, this is a decision that you should reverse. You know, first of all, it's a ridiculous one, and, you know, something that, you know, very well might be thrown out in court, or would have been thrown out in court if Trump had been reelected and this had moved ahead. But it's one that the Biden administration can easily reverse. But it also shows us, you know, this is an agency we need to keep an eye on, and we need to, you know, watch their decisions concerning fossil fuels. I mean, you know, to speak more broadly, this is, you know, one area where, you know, most of us are at a disadvantage when we go up against capitalists, you know, that they, federal government's most significant decisions, you know, often aren't, you know, these big things that appear in the news, Supreme Court decisions, legislation that's passed. You know, for the most part in the U.S., legislation is, you know, fairly broad, and then the actual working of these laws is left up to executive agencies. And, you know, you have a long process of writing rules, reaching decisions, and, you know, who shows up at these hearings, who participates? Well, you know, the corporations have a huge financial interest, so, you know, it pays for them to hire lawyers, lobbyists, scientists to be there in these agencies every single day and chiming in, you know, offering their sorts of bogus financial and scientific analyses to try to push against real regulation. And, you know, the only way to prevent corporations from having the decisive influence is that the rest of us have to find ways to be present as well, whether it's creating and financing organizations that will hire their own experts. And, you know, if we look at Ralph Nader, this is his big contribution, you know, over his career. This is, you know, the innovation that mattered, that he created these various public citizen groups that raised money and hired experts and really set a model for how to push against that. But, you know, we need to create many more such organizations. And on top of that, we need to find ways to, you know, alert the rest of us. So, you know, it's not enough to say, I'm going to donate money. There's going to be this organization. They're going to have some people with expertise sitting in there. They're going to push back. You know, the next step is when they identify these maneuvers, you know, they have to let the rest of us know, and we have to take to the streets to protest. We need to bombard members of Congress to say, here's an outrageous decision that's about to be made. You know, we're watching you. You need to stop that.
Well, I want to ask you more about the strategies that have been effective in making the fossil fuel industry too risky an investment. And you're talking about targeting institutions, including targeting regulators, as one part of that. But you mentioned three others, and I wonder if you can talk about and give us some concrete examples of how they have succeeded. One is the location of disruptive protests. And you, of course, are arguing that disruptive protests are absolutely fundamental in these interlock strategies. So tell us about disruptive protests and where in particular they have focused their energies.
Well, I mean, the most successful ones have been against pipelines. And pipelines are essential to the fossil fuel industry. It doesn't do any good to drill in the Dakotas, in Alaska, in northern Canada, if you can't get what you've drilled, you know, to consumers. And, you know, the only financially viable way to do that is with pipeline. You know, you can't load it onto trucks. You know, you can't load it onto train cars. You know, that, you know, just, you know, if the price is really high, if it's $80 a barrel, maybe you can do that, but you never get the volume. And of course, as the price gets lower, you know, then the cost of delivery becomes too high. And these pipelines, for the most part, are in remote areas. So protesters have to, you know, somehow get to these places. And these pipelines run through or near reservations, lands where indigenous people live. And a big shift is that, you know, indigenous people in the U.S., in Canada, become much more political, you know, much more willing to protest against projects that destroy the lands where they live. And they've really been at the forefront. You know, they've provided the bodies that have slowed and stopped these pipelines. And on the other side, you know, they've also been the targets of repression, you know, by national and state level government in the U.S. and in Canada as well. And so, you know, these have been, you know, real battles. And to the extent that they've slowed or stopped these pipelines, they've been fundamental in limiting the production of new fossil fuels.
Richard Lockman is my guest. We're talking about the essay that he co-authored, A Tipping Point for the Defeat of Fossil Fuels, How to Stop Big Energy in Its Tracks, quite literally. And that was published by Tom Dispatch and at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to the essay. He's the author of First Class Passengers on a Sinking Ship. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So another strategy of this sort of quartet of interlock strategies that you think have been particularly effective has been around filing lawsuits. Tell us about the role of lawsuits and where you've seen that to be successful.
Well, I mean, there's some very good laws on the books. During the, you know, first environmental movement in the late 1960s and early 1970s, a number of laws were passed, and most centrally the National Environmental Policy Act. And, you know, that requires federal agencies to conduct environmental impact studies. And, you know, if those studies aren't rigorous enough, that provides an opening for environmental groups to file suit. And, you know, in some cases that has absolutely stopped projects, but at a minimum, it delays things. You know, the project isn't allowed to move ahead until their court hearings. You know, these are complex matters. You know, they're scientific. Data needs to be analyzed. You know, judges are, you know, not that, you know, they don't have the expertise to do that. So that means everything comes to a halt while they need to appoint experts to analyze that. And, you know, so that can create delays of years and years in these projects, and that raises costs. And it also creates the real possibility that some of these projects are going to be permanently blocked. And, you know, a number of cases they have, and a development in recent years is that some existing projects have been shut down. You know, some pipelines that have been operating for decades have been ordered to, you know, be turned off because they didn't meet the provisions of these laws.
Another strategy that you flag is pressuring banks, insurers, and other large institutions from divest from fossil fuels. And in this hour, you've talked about the crucial role of banks and insurers and so on. There are those on the left who have also criticized divestment from fossil fuels as not ultimately hurting the bottom lines of the fossil fuel companies, given how investment can work. Can you explain how you think that it does?
You know, it certainly makes new projects non-viable. And, you know, I think, you know, we need to recognize that there's an existing industry. You know, they've already, you know, invested hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, creating oil and gas fields, pipelines, refineries, and so on. And, you know, getting that part shut down, you know, is going to require, you know, a focus not directly on the oil companies, but rather on increasing wind and solar energy, pressuring utilities to buy that energy, especially because it's, you know, by, you know, in part by legislation, in part by just making them be economically rational and buy the cheapest sources of energy rather than keep buying oil and gas that is going to be more and more expensive in relation to wind and solar. So, you know, I think, you know, with the oil companies, you know, our focus has to be on just stopping the creation of, you know, new sources of oil and gas. I mean, ironically, one of the consequences of that's going to be, and I mentioned that earlier, that if these oil companies, you know, can't spend the enormous amounts in exploration and bringing to production of new sources of oil and gas, their profits are going to go up. You know, they're not going to be wasting billions of dollars on projects that might never reach fruition, or if they do, will turn out not to be profitable. And so, you know, in a sense, we're doing a favor to the owners of these oil and gas companies. You know, they're going to have a number of years where they're going to be pulling out gigantic profits from their existing sources. But, you know, in not too many years, you know, these companies are going to disappear. And, you know, I think, you know, the crisis of climate change is, you know, so fundamental. You know, if we don't solve this, you know, there won't be human civilization anymore. You know, this is a matter of life or death, not just for millions of individuals in the most vulnerable situation, but, you know, for our future as a species on this planet. And, you know, so we need to focus our energies on what's going to get the biggest impact in terms of cutting CO2 emissions. And, you know, that, you know, as much as, you know, we'd like to deliver justice to the owners of oil and gas who've gotten rich by destroying our climate, you know, we might have to put up with the reality that they're going to continue to make a lot of money for a few years, even as, or in part because, we shut off new opportunities for them to, you know, expand the realm of oil and gas.
Much of the discussion in recent years about slowing down the climate crisis has focused on this idea of a Green New Deal. And I wanted to ask you, what your take is on that, and what's the real chance for Green New Deal legislation to come to pass as things stand?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, even the Democrats capture these two seats and have formal control of the Senate. Some of the Democrats, you know, above all, Joe Manchin is from West Virginia, which is a coal state, you know, are not going to be supporting an expansive Green New Deal. But that doesn't mean nothing will happen. You know, I think there's a recognition that there's a need for large amounts of investment in infrastructure, and, you know, the economy is going to be weak for a number of years. So programs that create, you know, jobs in construction of any sort are going to be welcome. And so, you know, while I don't expect there's going to be massive federal investment in wind and solar, you know, probably, you know, we can get out of Congress with our pressure, investment in creating a smart energy grid, which is essential to, you know, making it possible for wind and solar to become the dominant sources of energy. And, you know, in part, we don't need the federal government for much of this. You know, wind and solar already is cheaper than coal, oil, and gas. So, you know, certainly investment in research would be welcome, but, you know, this is something where, you know, the work has already been done. These projects can move ahead. They can be financially justified. And, you know, what's needed is the sort of grid that will make that possible. And in part, these are things that can be accomplished on a state level, that, you know, utilities are regulated by states, mainly, not by the federal government. And so this is a struggle that is going to have to take place state by state. We're going to have to pressure the state utility boards to demand that all new sources of energy be green energy, and to change the way in which utilities pay for energy, because that's another source of subsidy for oil, coal, and gas. But, you know, those existing plants, you know, are given a privileged position in the systems by which utilities buy energy, so that even though they're more expensive, in many states, the state utility regulatory boards demand that the utilities buy this oil, coal, and gas energy. And so this is something that we can reverse state by state.
You've just focused on the importance of bringing battles to the regulation of utilities and the composition of utilities state by state. But what would you say are the places that you think activists and listeners who might want to throw their support behind such efforts, where do you think they should focus their efforts? What are the places that are most crucial right now? Would you say what you just mentioned, or is that part of a spectrum?
I mean, I think it's, you know, there are many places that we can put pressure on. And, you know, in part, you know, we can be most effective, you know, in the states where we live. You know, I think, you know, many of us live in states where there's no fossil fuel energy production. You know, there aren't pipelines, but, you know, we can put pressure on the state governments to, you know, demand that the state utility regulatory boards, you know, change their systems so that only green energy is purchased. And at the same time, you know, we can offer support, you know, especially to indigenous people who are on the front lines trying to block these new pipelines and these new sources of extraction. You know, and then, you know, I think beyond that, you know, we need to engage with groups that argue for the Green New Deal. That, you know, for decades, environmentalism has been presented as something that kills jobs. But the reality is it's the opposite, that green energy is much more labor intensive than oil, coal, and gas. And the enormous work that needs to be done to, you know, rebuild homes and offices, to construct transportation systems that can run on green energy are going to create millions of jobs in construction and well-paying jobs. And so I think, you know, on a political level, we need to make that point again and again and again so that people won't believe this argument that green energy is job killing. And if we're able to achieve that, you know, I think that will play a major role in shifting the debate at the national level, and, you know, will create the basis of popular support that will force administrations, whether Democratic or Republican, and members of Congress, whether Democratic or Republican, then to support green energy. This is something we won't accomplish immediately, but we need to accomplish quickly because, you know, as we all know, time's running out. You know, levels of CO2 are getting very close to the point of no return. So it's, you know, really over the next 10 years that there has to be a decisive shift.
Richard Lachman, thank you so much for your time today.
It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Richard Lachman is a sociologist. He teaches at SUNY Albany, co-author of the essay, A Tipping Point for the Defeat of Fossil Fuels, How to Stop Big Energy in Its Tracks, quite literally. And on againstthegrain.org, you can find a link to that essay. He is the author of First Class Passengers on a Sinking Ship, Elite Politics and the Decline of Great Powers, which is published by Verso. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.